I'm Leslie Marshall. We also have that Congressman Ro Khanna. Congressman Khanna represents California's 17th congressional district. That includes Silicon Valley. And his focus is to create proposals for jobs in areas left behind and tax credits for the working class. He believes in exercising restraint in foreign policy, and he takes no PAC money. Awesome. Good to have back Congressman Ro Khanna. Congressman Khanna, thank you for joining us. Good afternoon and welcome back, sir.
Good afternoon, Leslie. Thanks for having me back on the show.
Good to have you with us. You tweeted, our elected officials have a choice. Either demand an end to U.S. support for Saudi war crimes in Yemen, or you will be complicit in the worst famine in the past 100 years. There is no middle ground here. Before we talk about Yemen, being on the brink of the world's worst famine in 100 years if this war continues, let's talk about Yemen. What do you want people to know about Yemen and to the Saudi contribution to this, which, by the way, Jamal Khashoggi spoke out against when he was writing in Saudi Arabia as a well-respected journalist before he fled his homeland?
Well, Leslie, first of all, thank you for bringing attention to this issue. It hasn't received nearly enough attention in the media, and I appreciate your covering it. Khashoggi's last column was exactly about criticizing the Saudi government for their involvement in Yemen. It's one of the reasons that the Saudis probably went after him and murdered him. There are 13 million, that's no exaggeration, 13 million Yemenis who are on the brink of famine. It would be the largest famine in the last 100 years. It puts crisis is so bad, it's more dire than Rwanda or Bosnia in terms of its scale. And the reason that this famine may take place is because the Saudis have been blocking access at the port of Hodeidah and the major ports to allowing humanitarian aid to get into Yemen. Now, the United States can stop the Saudi behavior. All it will take is for our Congress to say we are no longer going to support the Saudi bombing in Yemen. Where if we cut off our refueling of the Saudi planes, the Saudis will be forced to go to the bargaining table with Special Envoy Griffith at the United Nations and negotiate allowing humanitarian assistance and a resolution. So what we're literally talking about is saving millions of lives in Yemen.
I wanted to talk about that, Congressman. This is, I think you would agree, not a Democrat issue. You are a Democrat, so am I. Not a Republican issue. This does not have a party. Starvation does not ask who somebody votes for or what side they stand on politically. And when you talk about millions, 13 million allegedly people are at risk of starvation, according to the United Nations, in their warning that famine could overwhelm the country. And we are talking about in the next 90 days. Where does it stand in Washington with people on both the left and the right? Do they agree this is not a left or right issue, but rather a humanitarian issue that cannot be ignored?
I agree with you, Leslie, and we have had some thoughtful Republicans realize this. Rand Paul, the senator from Kentucky, Walter Jones in North Carolina, Thomas Massey in Kentucky, people who I disagree with on 90% of issues, but who see this first as a humanitarian crisis of enormous magnitude, and second, who understand that the United States' involvement in Yemen is not in our strategic interest. What is going on in Yemen is in part a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and we have no stake in that war. And there are many people on both the left and the right who are weary about the United States getting into yet another war in the Middle East. So I think the Khashoggi incident has permanently shifted the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia. I've analogized it to a marriage where one spouse cheats. Even if the marriage continues, the marriage will never be the same. And after Khashoggi, I have had conversations with both Republicans and Democrats who see the U.S.-Saudi relationship very, very differently. The key is going to be when we get back into this session after the elections, what action we will take. The biggest action we can take is passing the War Powers Resolution to stop our support of the Saudi war in Yemen. That's what they care the most about right now. And if we stop that, we will force them to the bargaining table.
You know, why is this something that for some listening to this show today, Congressman, it's the first they've heard about it? Not the war in Yemen, but the degree of starvation, how desperate and how the clock is ticking when we are 90 days approximately away or less of 13 million people dying, perhaps.
Yeah, but this just has not received the attention that it should. We have been focused on many domestic issues of great importance, but we have not. It's very hard to get the media or the public to focus on international issues. But the scale of this is so enormous. It is literally similar to Rwanda, similar to Bosnia. And our history tells us that when there are crises of that scale, we do pay attention and we do care because of basic decency. So I think these recent reports are a wake-up call for many Americans and people on the Hill. Now, you could say, well, why is it that we're still continuing the support of the Saudis? I mean, why would we possibly do that? And the rationale for it are two things. One, you have an administration that really has seen containment of Iran as the highest priority, and they view the Saudis as an ally in the fight to contain Iran. And second, Kushner and the Trump administration have bet on the Saudis as a partner of peace in their support of Israel. Both, I think, are flawed foreign policy decisions. But even if you buy their foreign policy, which I don't, certainly you don't think that 13 million people are a cost worth bearing for that foreign policy. So my hope is anyone of decency will say, look, let's stop this. Let's stop the Saudi bombing. Let's force them to allow humanitarian assistance and not subject millions of people to death through starvation.
I want to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk further with the congressman. Pick up the phone and join us if you have comments or questions regarding the tragedy that is taking place in Yemen. And as the congressman says, we have no choice. There is no middle ground. Yemen is on the brink of the world's worst famine in 100 years. In the next 90 days, next 3 months, 13 million people are at risk of starvation, a horrific way to die. We're talking children as well, people. I'm Leslie Marshall. Thank you for joining us. If you've just joined us or if you hung with us during the break, we were talking with Congressman Ro Khanna. He is the California 17th Congressional District Congressman. That includes Silicon Valley. We are talking about Yemen, who is on the brink of the world's worst famine in 100 years if this war continues. Before we switch gears here, Congressman, I want to continue to talk about this a bit more. We talk about it could be facing the worst Yemen a famine in 100 years. And this is if the airstrikes by the Saudi-led coalition are not halted. This has been a warning not only from the UN, but I believe also by our allies. Now, if war continues, famine could engulf the country in the next 3 months. We're talking about approximately 12 to 13 million civilians that are at risk of starvation, according to the humanitarian coordinator for Yemen. And she told the BBC, quote, "I think many of us felt as we went into the 21st century that it was unthinkable that we could see a famine like we saw in Ethiopia, that we saw in Bengal, and that we saw in parts of the Soviet Union. That was just unacceptable. Many of us had the confidence that would never happen again. And yet the reality is that in Yemen, that is precisely what we are looking at." Congressman, I want to ask, where do our allies stand with regard to this Saudi-led coalition? And, you know, what are we as a nation doing wrong or differently than our allies?
Well, many of our allies have stopped the support of the Saudis. We stand unique in that we continue to support the Saudi refueling of planes and assisting the Saudis in targeting. We are making the rationale that there is al-Qaeda in Yemen and we need to go after al-Qaeda. But the reality is that al-Qaeda in Yemen is actually aligned with the Saudis in taking out the Houthis. So we can have counter-terrorism operations in Yemen without aiding the Saudis in their war. And anyone who has studied this issue knows that if the United States stops refueling the Saudi planes, there's no way the coalition can continue to bomb. Second, if we stop selling the Saudis arms, the Saudis cannot continue. The president is misleading the American public when he says If we stop selling the Saudis arms, the Chinese and Russians will step in. The reality is all of the Saudi weapon systems are designed to be compatible with ours. That's why they buy most of their arms from us or NATO countries. And it would take them decades to switch over to Russian or Chinese arms. There simply is not interoperability. So if we halted our arms sales, that also would stop the war. One final point. Amartya Sen, the Nobel laureate economist who has written about famine, wrote almost a decade ago that famine is almost always a man-made problem. It's not because of a lack of food. It is a political problem. And we are seeing an ugly side of history repeat itself.
I agree with you 100%, Congressman. I'm glad you brought that to our attention. I want to talk about something else that you and many, myself included, are trying to bring to public attention. Election Day is coming, and some people have a difficult time getting to their polling places to vote. And some of the people have a difficult time doing that, whether it's an issue of transportation or, you know, they work one, two, three jobs, can't get a day off. You wrote, one reason for low voter turnout is that people are busy working and going to school on the pivotal day when Americans vote and decide the future. And I agree with you 100% on this, Congressman. The time has come, you said, we need to make Election Day a national holiday. This would benefit both Democrats and Republicans. I would think everybody would be high-fiving you and on board, and this would be a done deal in 5 minutes. What's going on, and what's the holdup, if there is any?
Well, you're absolutely right. Look, a lot of people don't vote because they can't afford to take an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours off from work to go to a polling place and cast a ballot. That is not easy. If you are a nanny, if you are a house cleaner, if you are working at a restaurant or a fast food place or at a retailer, where every minute is clocked. And if we made the Election Day a holiday, people would have no excuse and would really have the opportunity to vote. The reality, though, is, Leslie, there are people in this country who do not want to see everyone vote because they believe that the larger the voter turnout is, the more it hurts their electoral prospect. And this is why we have seen voter suppression tactics, purging of the rolls in places like Georgia, where 53,000 African Americans were taken off the voter rolls. And this is why there continues to be opposition to ideas like making Election Day a holiday.
Voter turnout in this country, Congressman, as you well know, was among the lowest in the world. In the midterm elections in 2014, 33% of the voting age population voted, and that set the record for the lowest voter turnout in any national election of any advanced democracy except Andorra, which some people have never heard of, since 1945. There are many reasons so few Americans vote, but we are also not just the lowest, we are also one of the only nations that, and one of the few countries that holds elections on a work day. And to your point, finding a time to vote during a work day, that imposes a significant burden, and that burden falls disproportionately on workers and students who frequently cite scheduling conflicts with work or school as their reason for not voting. If somebody in college has a final exam, you can't blow that off to go vote. And I think some people may go, oh, it's just my one vote, but then you add that up. Do you think that that has played into why in midterms Democrats have even lower voter turnout than Republicans, because our party does seem to have more of the millennials and more of the minorities who in this country, unfortunately, disproportionately make up a larger percentage of the blue-collar labor force than a lot of those rich white guys on the right?
Your diagnosis is absolutely correct. I mean, the reality is, if you're a working American, if you're a student, you often don't have control over your schedule. You know, as a congressperson, I get to control my schedule. If I say I'm not coming in for 2 hours, my staff adjusts. And many of us who have jobs where we get to be the boss or we get to be in positions of privilege, it's no big deal. But if you are the person who is cleaning the building, if you're the person who's a security guard, if you're a nurse, if you're a student, you don't have control over your schedule, and it's a much, much harder thing. The cost of voting is much higher. And that is why this disproportionately hurts Democrats or people. It disproportionately hurts lower income folks when you don't have an election holiday.
I want to take some calls. Let's go to the Bronx in New York with Michael first. Michael joining us on line one. Michael, good afternoon. Thank you for joining us. Question or comment for the congressman? And I do want to say this, because when we talk about the voters in Georgia, for example, who've had their rights infringed upon, you can't take out the racial element when you look at the numbers of African Americans that are asked to be taken off buses. And I mentioned this because Michael has shared with us. I've also met him in person at some of my personal appearances that he is African American. Michael, thank you for joining us, and I'm glad that you called to speak to what's happening and to discuss what's happening to the people in Georgia. Question or comment on that to our congressman?
Yes, a big time. Hello to you, Leslie. Hello to the congressman. The thing is that when you look at also the shenanigans that these Republicans are pulling and trying to direction, or should I say voting difficult, I take, for example, I'm so mad I forgot the guy's name, the guy, the GOP that's running for Georgia gubernatorial race against Stacey Abrams.
Brian Kemp.
Brian Kemp, thank you. He's Secretary of State, and he's controlling the elections, and yet he's a contender. I don't buy that one bit, because we all know he will fix the outcome to favor himself, and he should either be forced by a federal court order to recuse himself in Secretary of State powers and duties, or if he refuses, be disqualified, and Stacey Abrams be declared the winner by DQ and by default. You know, because the thing is that if the GOPs were facing this kind of disadvantage, if the roles were reversed, we all know they will be screaming mutiny and coming forth with their guns, claiming Second Amendment privilege, using the coin, the term coin, by the hero Trump. So, one another.
Okay, thank you. Michael, thank you. I want to give the congressman an opportunity to respond. Congressman, to Michael's point, would this be a whole different situation if it was Republicans that were being, you know, kept from their legal and constitutional right? And also, is it uncomfortable and unsettling to you? Does it smell rotten that, you know, Kemp's in charge of this, Kemp's running, and Kemp's in a neck-and-neck race with his Democratic opponent in Georgia?
Absolutely. I mean, Michael is absolutely right in the situation. Kemp disqualified 53,000 African-Americans from the voting rolls. Anyone with an ounce of decency would have recused themselves from the Secretary of State position if they were running also for governor. But Kemp is running a racially charged campaign. He actually is bragging about the fact that he is disenfranchising African-Americans. And you have a similar struggle there as we had during the Civil Rights Movement and the Voting Rights Movement. It's sad when you have John Lewis, as a colleague of mine, who talks about being beaten in 1965 on the Edmund Pettus Bridge so that these types of shenanigans wouldn't take place. And we're in 2018, and a Republican candidate is running proud of the disenfranchisement of 53,000 African-Americans. Stacey Abrams was a law school classmate of mine, and I said to her, I said she should refuse to concede. If the election outcome is illegitimate and she loses by thousands of votes, she should really refuse to recognize the legitimacy of this election. We have to be firm and stand strong. Certainly the Republicans would be ruthless if the shoes were on the other foot.
Again, talking about having a day off to vote, one thing that in doing research for the show today, Congressman, and to talk about this issue, and also when I'm on TV to, you know, debate the conservative I'm usually up against, is that there are some states in the United States that have laws that mandate time off to vote. Is that correct? And there are a few workers in America that know about this?
You know, I don't know the research, but that would be very promising. And I'll have my staff look at those states. Maybe that could provide a model for federal legislation.
Let's talk to somebody in California. In San Francisco on line three is Mark. Mark, good afternoon. Thank you for joining us. Question or comment for the congressman?
Yeah, the comment has to do with Steve Mnuchin lying about the deficit, and it's being caused by what he says is Social Security and Medicare. And I think the Democrats need to ask him to resign because he's destroyed this economy with his tax cuts. And these tax cuts, are all they're going to be is just a segue to cut Social Security and Medicare. It's a scam the Republicans have put on the American people. And I'd like to see the Democrats scream from the highest point of this mountain in the United States about what they're doing.
Thank you, Mark. Well, Congressman?
You're absolutely right. Look, I didn't agree with all of Bill Clinton's politics, but the reality is after he left the office, we had budget surpluses. So it wasn't Social Security or Medicare that were the problem. What then changed? Two things changed. One, George W. Bush gave extraordinary tax cuts to the very, very, very wealthy. And two, we started engaging in all these overseas wars in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and around the world. Those are the two causes of the deficits. That's why we had record deficits when George W. Bush left. Obama tried to rein in those deficits by stopping our engagement in Iraq and bringing some of the troops home, and by trying to repeal the tax cuts to the very rich. He succeeded in lowering some of the deficit, and then Trump gets in. He extends our military commitments. He increases the military budget, and he has huge tax cuts, again, for corporations and the wealthy. So the deficits have nothing to do with Social Security and Medicare. They have to do with tax policy and military interventionism.
Congressman, and thank you for that. I know that was off topic, but it's good to know that you know your job and you're prepared. I appreciate that. Let's go back to low voter turnout. Look, I'm a pessimist, Congressman, and I look at the numbers, 4 million worldwide in this country, millions of women that marched in the Women's March. We saw the day after President Trump was elected, hundreds of thousands of people marched. Many of them, when asked, when we sent our man on the street out to say, hey, who'd you vote for? Many of them said, I didn't vote. Some were Bernie or bus people. Some just thought Hillary had it in the bag, and some, well, like I say about us Democrats, we're great at protesting, we're great at marching, but in midterms, we have not been great at voting. Now, a lot of the numbers we've seen in primaries are encouraging. Do you really think we will have a blue wave or even a blue tsunami, as some are saying? Or do you think it'll, or do you think after Brett Kavanaugh and the polls, as you know, we are seeing them, that things are slanting more in Republican favor and that Democrats will take the House, you know, narrowly, but not the Senate, because that's a much tougher path?
Well, I think we have the opportunity for a blue wave, and we have the opportunity to win seats even in Texas like Beto O'Rourke. I mean, if you look at the polling, some polls show Ted Cruz up by 7 or 8, and then some polls show Beto O'Rourke up by 1 or 2. And you say, "How? What's the difference?" Well, the whole difference is, are millennials going to come out and vote? Are minorities going to come out and vote? If the traditional voting pattern holds, where only 20% or some of millennials are going to vote, then we won't win these seats. If we can get that percentage up with the Hispanic community, with millennials, then we could win almost all of these seats, both in the Senate and in the competitive House races. So it really does come down to turnout, and you're right to be concerned about that. I mean, having run for Congress, I can't tell you the number of people, young folks, or in my case, in the Indian American community, because I'm Indian American, who got so excited. I had people who wrote me a contribution, who hosted me in their homes, who forgot to vote. And so it's voting is a learned practice. It's something that is very difficult to get instilled in folks. And we just have to continue to figure out not just how to inspire, but the mechanisms of getting people to the polls and actually voting.
I agree with you 100%. Oh, Congressman, our time just flew. Thank you for taking the time. I know you're very busy, sir. I'm a fan. Good to have you with us. Congressman Ro Khanna, representing California's 17th congressional district. Hey, follow him on Twitter, at Rep Ro Khanna. That's REPROKHANA. The website is khanna.house.gov. That's khanna.house.gov.